Today, we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Oh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we delve into some of the big stories from around the world and here in Ireland in business and in politics. Coming up on today's show, first, we're going to hear from Caroline Vakil of The Hill in Washington as the US presidential race enters its final stretch. The Trump rallies are certainly as bizarre as ever, but he's still commanding all the headlines, and we'll hear about that and an interview that Kamala Harris did with Fox News. And back home this week, house prices here in Ireland have gone up by over 10%. It's marked the 12th consecutive month of rising house inflation. And we're going to talk about the access to credit for builders who are trying to build those homes and what it means for the prospective buyers. I'll be joined by AJ Noonan, CEO of Renellen Developments, and also Donal McEntee of the Business Bus. And finally, over 750,000 young people in the UK are now not in any education, employment or training. So we're going to discuss what's behind that worrying trend with Amy Borrett from the Financial Times in London. You can reach me as always at takingstock@newstalk.com or follow me on Twitter at StockNT. So let's start with those house prices, because a recent Business Post analysis has shown that Bank of Ireland and AIB, the domestic banks that finance the construction of homes, have dramatically shrunk their lending to building and the building industry in recent years. Joining me now to discuss is AJ Noonan, Managing Director of the Renellen Group, and Donal McNamee, Banking and FinTech Correspondent with the Business Post. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much.
Donal, I'm going to start with you, please. Just those figures that you took a look at with AIB and Bank of Ireland. Tell us exactly how the lending to the building industry has changed in recent years.
Yeah, we just, you know, we're in the middle of a housing crisis. Sort of every avenue has to be explored. We just had a look at the annual reports of AIB and Bank of Ireland, which are the two domestic banks that finance development in Ireland, over the last 15 or so years. And unsurprisingly, we found that their development lending has dropped fairly substantially in that time. We'll say at AIB, development lending, which encompasses residential and commercial, has fallen from 6.6 billion in 2011 to 992 million last year. And at Bank of Ireland, development lending has fallen from 3.7 billion in 2011 to 540 million last year. And I guess some of that is to be expected and welcome, given what we know happened in the lead up to the crash, and the sort of well-litigated overexposures of the sector to development lending. But it does kind of raise questions now, given the housing crisis that we're in at the minute, about the scale of that lending that from the banking sector.
Absolutely. Look, when you look at those figures collectively, that's gone from almost 10 billion collectively between those two banks down to just 1.4 billion at a time when the government themselves say we're in a housing crisis. And some analysis that was conducted by the Department of Finance found that the level of development finances that it needs to deliver even 33,000 homes, and there's lots of reports saying we need lots more than that, needs to be about 13.6 billion per annum, and 11.5% of that has to come from private capital sources. AJ, I'm going to bring you in here because we've spoken in the past about this issue a number of years ago, and this is not a landscape that would be alien to you, what Donal has outlined there.
Oh, not at all alien. In fact, I think Donal has articulated it quite well. Unfortunately, I mean, 10 or 15 years ago, there was multiple banks here lending billions upon billions. And now we're reduced to two pillar banks who, in fairness, them are tied with the tier one capital ratios. And that's the reason we lost KBC Bank and Ulster Bank, is because they could deploy their capital at a better return elsewhere. I think I read Donal's article, and he has alluded to the shortage of equity. Mm. And I think we need a whole of government approach to try and solve this. And he mentioned the state credit guarantee scheme, which is working very successfully for other industries. And I don't know why it's so alien that the construction industry is the maverick one, that we couldn't use it for that. I mean, the EIIS scheme, we have to figure a way to get in about 20-30% in equity participation into the sector. And then the banking really have to step up to the plate. And they hide behind the tier one ratios. And I think government have a massive role to play.
Mm.
We have a dysfunctional planning system. You know, there's talk about need for 60,000 units per year. There's not a chance in hell we get 60,000.
Yeah,
I mean, the boast last week was that we have the third largest piece of legislation passed. I mean, that's a shocking boast. It should be the smallest piece of legislation because it should be kept simple so people can apply for planning with confidence that they're going to get a reasonable product.
Yeah, before we get all tied up in Tier 1 regulations and all that, I want to bring it back a little bit, and I'll bring you back in here, Donal, if I can. AJ has alluded to the fact that the banks themselves are heavily regulated and constrained in what they can do. Just maybe try and give us, if you can, the very simple guide to that loan-to-cost ratio and why that's such a big issue for the small type of builders who want to get in on the market and why it's making it actually very difficult for banks to lend to them.
Yeah, the BPFI, in a report in recent months, that's the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, they said that typically their members, meaning AIB and Bank of Ireland in this context, they'll usually, their risk appetite is for about 65% loan to cost ratio, which means that they can lend about 65% of the value of a development. And that obviously leaves a 35% gap, which the developer has to find the money somewhere, whether they have it themselves in their balance sheet or whether they go and take in equity. That's obviously a big challenge for smaller or medium and developers, and that would have been sort of set out in the article as well, in the sense that they don't have the money themselves, and equity is really expensive. It's more expensive than the rates that the banks would charge for the debt finance they provide. So that's kind of a big problem, and that's where their proposal for that credit guarantee scheme comes in, where they say, look, to the government, look, will you guarantee 15% of the loan? And then we'll be able to be a little bit more generous without sort of compromising our credit underwriting standards.
And AJ, like, how would that credit guarantee scheme look like for someone like you? Would that substantially change things? Would it help your company to be more, I suppose, progressive or get in on more developments?
Yeah, it would. And I think the point that's been made there is that, like, the large developers, say the 50 million plus, it's not as difficult to get funding in that area. It's not that easy, but it's not as difficult. But say if a regional builder outside Dublin trying to build 20 or 30 houses, it is a really big challenge to fund that because their balance sheets aren't big enough to do it themselves. They take in the equity, which your journalist colleague has alluded is an expensive form of money. So it's reducing the opportunities to build product that's badly needed. I mean, the government takes 13.5% of every house as well. I mean, they could do a VAT abatement scheme or something like that to participate. This is all about getting... We're supposed to be in a housing crisis. I don't see much of it. I see a lot of virtue signalling. I mean, you look down in the Docklands, you have a restriction on height down there to about 10 or 15 stories. I mean, these sites won't be developed again for 80 or 100 years. They should be going up 60, 70 stories. We should be in encouraging international funds to come in instead of virtue signalling, whereby we increase stamp duty to 15% on bulk buying. These should be forward-funded products, and I think it worked fantastically well. But anyway, they don't listen to us, Mandy.
I'm sure they do. So sometimes. Donal, I'll bring you back in here because, look, the government's pushback on all of this would be, look, that ultimately viability is the key to attracting investment. And when a project is viable, the funding will be available. And that, therefore, is a big challenge, I guess, for someone coming into the market who has to consider cost inflation, interest rates, all of that type of stuff. But AJ mentioned earlier, like, doing business here for property developers and builders has got harder in recent years. Has that got something to do with the lack of interest in this area and perhaps a lack of lending? What I'm trying to get at in a long-winded way here is that has those loans from AIB and Bank of Ireland gone down because they don't want to lend or because there's not the interest there?
Possibly a little bit of both, but one interesting quote in that one of the developers I spoke to, Kieran Fitzpatrick, he said he's the managing director of Fitzpatrick and Evie Homes. He said, like, operationally, no problem. We could triple our business next year without question if there were more finance solutions there. And, you know, like, there is a crisis. There are clearly, it's a complicated problem. It's not as simple as if the banks lent more, then the thing will be fixed in the morning. But definitely the sense I got, and maybe AJ would have a better sense of it, was that if the finance was there, developers would be, you know, they're interested, and that in lots of cases they have the capacity to do it. They just don't have the money.
Mm. AJ, like, beyond that, the supply of credit, do you think that that's what's holding everything up, or
it's only a factor in it?
Mm.
We have a dysfunctional planning system. I mean, it's very, very hard. There's no lending for non-developing land that doesn't have planning.
Mm.
So the developer has to risk all their own resources to try and get planning on a site first. So that's a big issue. Supply of the cost inputs have gone through the roof since COVID. And then you have this raft and raft of legislation that is coming from government that increase the cost on all businesses, not just the construction business. So it's a factor. And I'd say it's a major factor, but it's not by any means on its own, man.
Yeah, no, some of the other constraints are, obviously, as you mentioned there, the funding of land, planning permission. Then there's the funding of the apartment development, which doesn't have a committed purchaser from the state.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, that's another...
But that's the point I'm making about the virtue signalling.
Mm.
We actually need to bring in capital. We should encourage capital in. We need a vibrant rental sector. It's not about all buying all this. And this is an enormous amount of virtue signalling going on. And you have, you know, you made the point there about planning and what have you. I call them, you know, like personal injuries folks. Well, I call them HIMAC chasers, lawyers. And they are now turning around on some of the social media and saying, this Planning and Development Act will keep us in business for years.
And AJ, like, as somebody who's in this, do you not see any merit in that piece of legislation, which, according to government,
again
is the second biggest, largest piece of legislation ever in the history of the state? Well, you know, it's going to, according to them, reconstruct planning laws. They have to do a big job of work on that themselves. Would you think it's just so big that it's too cumbersome and it won't have an effect?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And sad and all as I am, I watched some of the committee stage of this planning and development bill, and it was neutered by both government and opposition TDs to make it a shadow of what it possibly could be. And one of the thinnest pieces of legislation that was ever introduced in this country was the 1963 Planning Act, which served us very, very well for many, many years. There were many houses built, and they were built in great communities, were built houses with schools, banks, churches and what have you. And you can see all these towns throughout Dublin and throughout the country to this day.
Mm.
But I think when I hear big pieces of legislation, I think cumbersome, I think opportunity for the HIMAC chasing lawyers.
Well, look, I mean, you'd all have to accept as well that things have business, corporate rules and governance, planning laws, they've all got much more complicated and complex since 1963. And so, you know...
I understand all that, but by the same token, the point I'm making is, by saying that we have the third largest piece of legislation, doesn't mean it's a good piece of work. I'm saying that if the simpler things can be kept, the better.
Well, look, one of the other things, Donal, if I can bring you back in here, AJ calms down a bit about the Planning and Development Bill. The Home Building Finance Ireland, that fund that was established in 2019 to help the supply of new homes in the state through debt finance, what about that? Is that not something that helps with credit in the marketplace?
I think it does, yeah. The developers we spoke to said Yes, it's good, and they welcomed its establishment, and in fairness, ICIF, the investment fund, the state investment fund, has also in recent months made available an equity product as well. So there are solutions that the government are trying to make available. I think it's just, given how acute this crisis is and that everybody around the country accepts how acute it is, there's still clearly a gap when it comes to financing these projects.
We had a big discussion with one of your colleagues, actually, Donal, here on Taking Stock a couple of weeks ago about REITs in the marketplace as well. Beyond AIB and Bank of Ireland, when and the state funds, when a small and medium enterprise like AJ's or similar size companies trying to get, where else do they try and get credit from?
Non-bank lenders play a fairly substantial role as well. Central Bank report last year showed that bank development finance was 23%. Non-bank finance between debt and equity was 35% of the development financing. And then the remainder is direct state finance. So things like, as you say, HBFI. There are options out there, like non-bank lenders, I think, typically, and again, Asia might have a better sense of it, but the interest rates can be higher and stuff like so. So I suppose there is a sort of a patchwork of options out there. I guess the issues that's being raised is that there's a crunch, and that developers are maybe not able to be as active as they would otherwise like to be as a result of it.
AJ, when we spoke here the last time, this was exactly the issue you were warning about, actually. And do you see that? I know your views on the planning and development bill, so we don't need to rehearse that. But do you see anything shifting in a positive way to bring more people into Ireland to do exactly the type of building that the Central Bank and the Housing Commission and everybody is going to promise us now in this general election?
No.
Okay, well, that's right. I have nothing positive to say
that's not fair. I mean, the point that HIPFI, positive example, there are 200 lending platforms in that 35%. So there are, but they're cherry-picking opportunities in terms of, like, Dublin. Dublin is a lot easier to finance something than in the regions. And the further you go down, so we'll have a very Dublin-centric construction industry if we're not careful.
And just explain why that is, AJ. Why is it?
Well, you're more certain of your return. So if you build a residential scheme in Dublin, you're going to have a better chance of selling it, and therefore you'll have a better chance of funding it at a more attractive rate than, say, in a regional town, mm-hmm. where it's more difficult. So that's a pretty simple word. HIPFI are a very positive addition to the marketplace. Permanent TSB, to be fair to them, do a bit of work on the social housing front, and they I think they're going to have a huge opportunity over the next 5 to 10 years. So I suppose I shouldn't be totally negative.
No, God forbid. And the final word to you on this as well, Aisha, just leave it. The role of the approved housing bodies, is that approving things at all?
The approved housing bodies play a huge role in the marketplace in terms of forward purchasing your product, so that you actually have a sale that you can then bank. And that's why developers prefer to sell to one group. And that's why there's such a shortage of housing for young families starting out as well. The big issue coming down the tubes is water, in terms of, like, Dublin is running out of water. And that will be the next big problem. And it's going to take 7 years get that through the planning system.
Yeah, look, we have actually touched on that issue before, and I've no doubt it's something that we'll come back to in the coming weeks. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Donal McNamee, banking and fintech correspondent with the Business Post, and AJ Noonan, managing director of the Rennellan Group. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we'll discuss why over 3/4 of a million young adults in the UK are inactive in the system. We'll explore what's driving this phenomenon, with Amy Borrett from the Financial Times in London.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Ooh, I like it.
So you saying hip hop could be hop hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Tuned. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, do you know the difference between youth inactivity and youth unemployment? Well, our nearest neighbours in the UK are going through quite a startling rise in youth inactivity at the moment. But what does that term mean? And how does it even affect young people themselves and the wider UK economy? Well, Amy Borrett is a data journalist with the Financial Times, and she's been writing about this subject recently. And I'm delighted to say that she joins me on the line. Amy, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, Mandy.
Now, just the term itself, youth inactivity, what exactly is that?
So inactivity is the proportion of people who are unable to start work or not actively seeking employment. So it's different from unemployment, where young people might be trying to find a job but unable to do so.
Yeah, so these are people who are not either in employment, but they're also not in any training, and they're not in any kind of program that would set them forward into the employment market. That, am I right?
So some people, some young people who are inactive are students. That is one of the reasons why we're seeing a rise. But actually, it's mainly driven by other trends.
And what are those trends?
Well, we're seeing quite a concerning rise in long-term sickness. So the number of young people who are inactive because they have some kind of health condition. Obviously, for older age groups, you see a lot of physical illnesses. But for younger people, it tends to be mental illnesses that are keeping them out of the workplace.
Mm. And this article that you did, I found it fascinating. Let's just talk a little bit about who we're talking about here, what age group we're looking at.
So we're mainly talking about 18 to 24 year olds. So people who've left school and found themselves looking for their first job.
Inactivity itself as a national piece of data, how is that actually calculated? What are you looking at?
So you're using the Labour Force Survey to look at the number of people who have reported that they're out of work and the reasons why they're out of work. So it's a sum of people who are young people who are in education, people who are long-term sick, people who might be looking after the home, and looking at the proportion of that overall population that within the age group who are doing one of those things.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the figures, Amy. What did you find? Like, how high is it now? And what was it like at its, I suppose, when these figures started? And incidentally, when did they start looking at this?
So we've been collecting some of these figures for quite a long time. And as you can imagine, there are certain periods in the past, for example, after the financial crisis in 2008, where you see particularly high rates of young people who are inactive or unemployed. What's so interesting about what's happening at the moment is that it's actually more inactivity and not unemployment that's driving young people not being in the workplace, which is quite unusual. And so if you look over the last couple of years, so since the start of the pandemic, you've seen that the proportion of young people aged 18 to 24 who are inactive has actually increased over 10%, whilst for all working age adults, it's only increased about 4%. So it's a much more prevalent issue among younger age groups than it is among older age groups.
Mm. Yeah, and that's quite a diversion, isn't it, between the overall unemployment and inactivity rate in the younger population. But one of the things that you state in the article, or say in the article, is that the worklessness has been driven partly by post-pandemic mental health crisis, which has affected young people in the UK at a much higher rate than their peers in other developed economies. So why is that?
It's hard to know. It's something, it's quite difficult to put your finger on whether there is a much worse mental health crisis in the UK or whether there are other structural drivers. For example, people have pointed out to me that it might be slightly easier to get to get health related benefits and therefore can kind of sign on to get those in the UK than it is in other countries. I think, you know, whether or not it is the system or there is a kind of broader crisis that's driving it, it's still obviously very concerning for policymakers who want to, you know, boost our economy and also provide young people with the best possible opportunities that they can have.
Mm. Yeah, just back to the figures again for a second, Amy. Like, the inactivity rates for people aged 18 to 24 exceeding 35%. That's an incredible, that's over one third of that particular demographic.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to note that a lot of that is driven by students. So you do have a lot of people aged 18 to 24 who are in education. And, you know, as the analysts point out to me, that is good and inactivity in a way if people are investing in their future. What we're seeing, though, the reason why it has increased beyond where it was before is not because, it's largely not because of that, and certainly not because of that among young men. Mm. Young women are far more likely to be going into education in that age group than young men. What we're actually seeing is for them a concerning rise in long-term sickness and in unemployment. So the kind of bad inactivity that's not necessarily going to result in better labour market outcomes further down the line.
And over and above the mental health issues that you've spoken about there, are there other types of long-term illnesses that might be pushing those figures up for that particular age bracket, other than the mental health concerns?
I mean, it is predominantly mental health concerns. That is the main driver. Obviously, you do see a rise in other conditions like cancer, for example. I've written in the past about why there is quite a concerning rise of cancer rates among younger people because of the different lifestyles and exposures that we have now. But in terms of the drivers, it is predominantly mental health.
And with, you know, growing numbers of people being inactive at that particular age, what is the prospect for them to actually try and get into training, get into the workforce, like the long-term implications for them? What are they doing to try and deal with this issue in the UK?
What we noticed is that there's actually a very strong correlation between the people who are inactive and the people who have lower skills. So it's far more likely for someone who has fewer qualifications to find themselves inactive due to ill health. And that suggests that it's not just about solving that crisis for policymakers. They also need to look at how they can upskill the workforce. And one of the big issues that we have in the UK is that there isn't a very good post-18 offering in education for children who don't want to go on to university. So people who might want to do apprenticeships or other forms of further education, maybe more vocational skills that they want to build, it's very hard. So building out that offering and helping to provide a path to employment is really important, because it's hard to know whether the mental health crisis is what's stopping people getting out of work, or the degree to which not being able to have a job is contributing to those mental health issues.
Mm. And you mentioned earlier there that males are far more likely to be in this bracket than females. Why do you think that is?
I think there are very different decisions that young people make based on whether they are girls or boys, because girls tend to do a lot better at school and maybe feel that they need the investment in their education more to get on because there are more barriers in the workplace to them. And I think a combination of those things means they're more likely to choose to go on to university or to choose to go into education if they can't get a job. Whereas what we find is far more men don't fall into that category. And if they don't, when they leave school, they're not going on to university at such high rates. And this is causing quite a big divergence. Mm. And especially now that the job market is tightening and jobs are increasingly demanding higher levels of skills, that's benefiting the people who have invested in their education, such as women, whilst men are kind of struggling to get jobs because there aren't as many of the kind of minimum wage or low skill jobs as we had in the past.
And do you think that the lack of those type of jobs has something to do with the type of industries, societies that we're constantly hearing that, you know, countries like the UK and indeed here in Ireland, we're trying to attract those high skilled, high level jobs. Maybe there's just not enough of the other type of jobs being created to provide employment for these type of people who, you know, with some encouragement, with some access to apprenticeships, could actually be prompted into the workforce.
Yeah, I think it's important not to see this just as a cyclical thing, but also to look at the long-term trends. What we're seeing is a big shift in terms of the skills that are needed within our workforce. And as you said, the UK and Ireland and economies like that are moving increasingly towards those high-skill jobs. And in 10, 15 years' time, we won't have anywhere near as many people who need those kind of vocational skills, but we will need a lot of people who've invested in digital skills and in other training that maybe usually you'd get at university. But if that's not the kind of route that people want to pursue and not the way that they would best learn these skills, we need to think of other ways of giving them the skills they need so that they can take up these jobs, because we will need people to do them. We need to think of pathways that are appealing to people so that we can get to that point.
Mm. And I saw this week as well that the Labour Party brought in some conditions for workers' rights over there. You know, the employment debate in the UK at the moment. What is that like? And because I was interested in something that you said earlier on, that back in 2008, when employment here and all around the world was obviously suffering, it wasn't exactly, this doesn't mirror employment trends, say, on a national level. So what is that employment landscape like in the UK at the minute? Here we have a crisis of a different nature. We have virtually no unemployment, and you know, the fight for talent and skills is quite acute here. What's the labour market like in the UK?
We've definitely seen a slowdown in the labour market overall, and for graduates, it's been particularly acute. One of my colleagues actually published a piece earlier this morning that showed that part of that's been driven by competition, because people are using AI to write their CVs. You're getting more and more people applying for fewer and fewer jobs. And the employment landscape is obviously changing because of the changing government. We're going to get a budget next week, which will hopefully point, you know, to some of the big changes that we're likely to see. But what we've learned so far is that the Labour has brought in this legislation they promised to kind of overhaul employment rights. But there's going to be a lot more consultation on some of the aspects because of concerns that businesses have expressed. And so we might not see some of those changes actually be implemented for a number of years.
Well, Amy, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today and take us through what I thought was a fascinating article in the Financial Times last week. That was Amy Borat, who is a data journalist from the Financial Times. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we'll take a closer look at Donald Trump's campaign rallies and the growing questions around his mental stability. Caroline Vakil from The Hill will be with us just 2 weeks out from voting day now, so don't go anywhere.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello!
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Oh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to the US, because voting has actually begun in some of the states as the US presidential campaign enters its final weeks. Now, we might all be sniggering, and some of us even openly laughing at some of the former President Trump's antics, but there's also a really shrill tone of violence coming from some of his latest speeches and appearances. And I'm delighted to be joined now by The Hill's Caroline Vakil, who's going to bring us up to date with the latest news from America. Caroline, you're very welcome back to Taking Stock.
Thanks so much for having me, Mandy.
Caroline, let's start off today with a little clip of Donald Trump at one of those rallies.
Let's not do any more questions. Let's just listen to music. Let's make it into a music. Who the hell wants to hear questions, right? Let me hear that music, please.
Everyone, let's thank music. President
loud.
Trump.
Nice and loud.
God bless you.
This is the main world. So play YMCA. Go ahead. Let's go. Nice and loud.
Here we go, everybody.
And turn that music up. Turn it up. Great song. It goes
like this. So, look, that was a 30-odd second clip of what was a 39-minute dance routine. Caroline, what was that all about?
Sure. So, you know, at one point in one of his events, he got interrupted multiple times, and they ended up just taking the opportunity to listen to some music. Not necessarily what we would expect out of a typical Trump campaign event, but that was clearly a unique instance. But he's basically been crisscrossing the road. Unlike that one event, he's been in all of these different battleground states. You know, the election is coming down to the wire. He's making his case. He has surrogates, including his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, trying to do all of these events in front of, you know, different voting blocks. And you've also seen both Trump and Vice President Harris making the celebrity circuit court as well, on different podcasts, TV shows, even trying to go into some more unfriendlier you know, territory as well.
Yeah, and that we'll talk about Kamala Harris in a second about what she's been up to this week. But those events and this really strange demeanor he had at that rally in particular that you referenced there, and we played a clip from, led a lot of people to question his medical capacity and this call again for his medical records to be released. What was his response to that?
Well, you know, I think that basically what Vice President Harris has been doing has been trying to put Trump on the defense. I mean, she released a doctor's note, which was glowing in review and saying that she was very healthy and to be running for president. And, you know, for him, the campaign re-upped a doctor's note that his former physician, who's now a congressman, Ronnie Jackson, had issued a while back saying that he was in great health. But obviously, you know, both campaigns are trying to put the other on the defensive. Mm. Harris is starting to make this a bit more about age implicitly. And Trump campaign is trying to respond to that.
Mm. And he's done a series of interviews. One of the other ones that caught my attention this week was the one that he did with Bloomberg, which was also quite, testy, if you like, and the interviewer openly sort of laughing at him, but the audience in the room really responding well to him again.
And I think that, in a way, this is kind of one of the, I think, kind of key components to Donald Trump when he interviews. Even though he might be in potentially unfriendly territory, or it could just be a very straightforward, I mean, they were talking largely about the economy, for example, he can use those moments to show his vigor and aggression, his fighter persona that I think are what a lot of supporters of his base are attracted to. And so he's not going to back down without a fight. And that's, you know, certainly what was on display. Mm. You know, we've also seen this play out more recently with Fox News' Bret Baier and Vice President Harris. They had a very testy exchange as well. But I think those moments kind of can help serve to kind of, you know, it's kind of like doing curl-ups or push-ups. You know, every rep you get in, you get a little bit better. And I think for them, they're trying to be able to appeal to different audiences, even being able to kind of fight back a little bit and just show, you know, that they can kind of stick up for their own records, which I think is kind of what both Trump and Harris have been doing more recently in those kind of interviews.
Mm. You mentioned that interview with Kamala Harris and Bret Baier from Fox News. Let's take a quick listen to that interview.
Talked about locking people up because they disagree with him. This is a democracy. And in a democracy, the president of the United States, in the United States of America, should be willing to be able to handle criticism without saying he'd lock people up for doing it.
Caroline, this is something that's increasingly coming into his rhetoric, this notion that when the election happens, he's already sort of conditioning a lot of people to think that if the result is not going his way, that they will fight the system. How just talk to me a little bit about how dangerous that type of language is becoming.
I think that we can sort of look back no further than January 6th to see how rhetoric like that played out. And, you know, we've also seen the issue of the last presidential results as being a litmus test. Mm. Senator J.D. Vance, for example, has been asked a number of times whether he believes the 2020 election results were stolen, if Donald Trump lost the election. There was a while where he kind of dodged it, and he kind of gave his most extensive answer yet, kind of refuting that during a rally or a campaign event, I should say, in Pennsylvania, I believe on Wednesday, in which he said no, not to the words that I would use, essentially, just to paraphrase what he was saying. And so I think kind of that setting the stage for 2024, you know, you're already seeing key Republican officials who are more than comfortable to potentially, you know, they're refuting the 2020 elections. It's kind of raising questions about what that's going to mean for 2024. You alluded to earlier, Trump has been using increasingly dark language in some of his campaign events and rallies. And, you know, it is an open question mark, but we certainly saw how some of this did play out in January 6th, you know, only 4 years ago.
Mm. Caroline, what's next for the two campaigns? Any idea whether Trump is going to stick to this strategy or it's going to get worse, or what is Kamala Harris going to be up to in the coming weeks?
Sure. Well, with Donald Trump, you can never really predict. Donald Trump, even his aides have said, the only person who is a reliable predictor or communicator will be Donald Trump. So we're going to be all sort of watching to see how he's going to set the tone, sort of in this last stretch, as well as Vice President Harris. I mean, a lot of this is going to be crisscrossing the battleground states. The polling has increasingly showed this is a tight race. And I know that might sound sort of like an ad nauseum for viewers in Ireland, for example, but it really is the truth. I mean, the polling has just shown within the margin of error consistently. And so, it's not too difficult to think that we might have an election week where we're kind of waiting to hear, sort of down to, provisional ballots and all that. Who's going to be winning some of these key states like Georgia, Arizona, Nevada? We can expect to see them stepping up their interviews. Of course, we're seeing them both going into more unfriendly territory, going on to late night shows, using their surrogates as well. But it's really going to come down to the wire. We have about 3 to 4 weeks left, which is crazy. And it's really just going to be staying the course at this point.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of times now they're going into enemy territory. So let's talk a little bit about Kamala Harris's efforts to do just that on Fox News. How do you think that she performed, and who is she trying to speak to by going on Fox News?
Sure. That's a great question. I think that, while I will say from the outset, it was a very testy interview, no doubt about that. There were times where Bret Baier did cut her off, and I think you could see her visibly a little bit frustrated. But that being said, I think she did certainly try to stand her ground. She was being asked a lot of questions about immigration at the outset, which is something that she's been repeatedly on defense about. Republicans have used that as a big talking point against her and have, dubbed her the border czar. In terms of the kind of voters that she's appealing to, Fox News, it's traditionally a Republican-leaning network. So she's trying to go for some of those Republican-leaning voters who maybe are, considering voting for Trump again, but maybe are skeptical or open to a new option. Independents, centrists. Those are the kind of people that she's trying to appeal to. I think she's also trying to prove to voters that she can be comfortable in a setting that's not MSNBC, for example.
Yeah.
And so kind of why she's on there.
Yeah, and brave and not afraid to go into his territory, a bit like she behaved in the debate, I think. Caroline, when you were on here before President Biden stepped away from this campaign, spent a lot of time explaining to us the phenomena of double negatives, the voters who didn't want to vote for either Joe Biden or Donald Trump. What has she done to try and tap into that particular part of the electorate, in your view?
So I think that her candidacy in some ways did address that very thing, because what I think a lot of Democrats were looking for was a different candidate that was not President Biden, who was not, 80 plus years old. She is 59, I believe. And so I think in a lot of ways, we saw some of her base come back to her, younger voters, voters of color. She has also tried to take rhetoric to kind of empathize more vocally about the Israel-Gaza conflict, which I think has made some voters, progressives, Arab Americans, Muslim voters, and that, have concerns over those sort of issues, for example, a little bit more hopeful, although it's also unclear right now how she would differentiate herself and her approach from President Biden. So in some ways, her candidacy kind of did shore up her base from the outset, but that sugar high has now started to fade. And it's kind of an open question mark if she's able to get all of her base to come home for her in November.
Yeah, and that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And you mentioned the polls, and I know it does sound a bit repetitive from us all that everything's on a knife edge. We're just a bit removed here, so trying to get your sense of it is very important to us. If you look at what she's trying to do, so 53% of the electorate in America are women, you'd have to think that at least, you know, the majority of those will understand that she's better for them, but she's trying to tap into the women's vote. She's trying to look at younger voters. She's looking at people of colour. She's looking at younger women. And she's looking at those undecided voters across the United States who didn't want either candidate. On the other side, he is a racist. He is an authoritarian who's promising this new world order and not shying behind any of it. And I suppose the concern or question from this remove is, why isn't the dial shifting at all for her in that situation? He's doing exactly the same as he did before, and she's doing everything she can, and albeit it's only 100 days, but should the dial not be moving a little bit more for her now?
That's a great question. I think in a lot of ways, you know, kind of going back to the earlier point, the dial is shifting back a little bit towards her because she has sort of been the Democratic Party has been able to sort of respond to one issue, which is having a different candidate, someone who's a little younger, not having President Biden again. So they have been, you know, responsive in that concern. Obviously, Democrats have been trying to lean in on a whole host of issues, like abortion, threats to democracy, what we could see in a second Donald Trump administration, definitely leaning into Project 2025, which the president and his team, former President Trump and his team, have definitely tried to distance themselves from and say that it doesn't speak on behalf of them. But I think in a lot of ways, you know, Donald Trump has been making this pitch, are you better than you were, or are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And the economy is a big issue. Border and immigration are also a key issue. And so those are kind of the issues that are weighing on voters' minds when they try to make up that very question you're asking.
And I guess if you're in one of the swing states, you're having a very different immersive type of experience than we're having over here in little old Ireland, where you're just being pummeled, I would imagine, every day with various different offerings from both of the parties who want to speak directly to you.
Well, being situated in D.C. is definitely a very different environment than being in a swing state. But I will say that both campaigns are definitely trying to make their policy pitches. Trump, great example. He has been trying to talk. He made a policy announcement in Nevada, which has a big service sector economy, saying that he wouldn't tax tips. When he was in Arizona last week, he wanted to offer incentives for, you know, hiring 10,000 more Border Patrol agents, and Arizona's a border state. So they're obviously trying to, you know, read and kind of offer these policy proposals that are going to be palpable to some of these really critical battleground states that are going to be determining this election. The big question is it going to work?
And Caroline, you know, you cover all of this. You've been watching the campaign. We're coming into the final stages of it now. Where does someone like you go to actually do the final week or the final days? Do you stay at your desk in the hill, or do you take off around the road?
Definitely hunker down at my desk. But even though I'm in D.C., I'm definitely texting, calling a lot of my sources. I talk to a lot of sources, primarily in Arizona and Nevada. Those are some of the states that I've just been particularly interested in. And it's interesting to kind of get a sense of how things are going. You know, also keep in mind, too, that while there is a White House election, there's also a lot of other critical races going on at the same time. Some of those being Senate races, which are being concurrent alongside the presidential race. So Nevada, Arizona, for example, those are two swing states that also have Senate seats up for grabs this cycle. You know, we're likely to see some split ticket voting in a place like Arizona. And so I think that's going to offer some clues. And it's also going to kind of muddy some views about, you know, how people are feeling. Not going to stop until
November. We can promise one thing. It's certainly not going to be dull. With Caroline, we probably won't be talking to you this side of the election, but we hope to link in with you again after to get your take on what has happened. But for now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Caroline Vakil from The Hill. Caroline, thank you very much once again.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first every Friday morning on the News Talk app. My thanks to all of today's guests. Our producer was John Fardy, researcher was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane, and the sound engineer was Hugo De Silva Scott. If you have any comments or any questions on today's programme, please do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello.
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Ooh, I like it.
So you saying hip hop could be hop hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.